I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and I'm so glad you could make it tonight to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern, our ongoing lecture series. We have one more lecture for the fall series 2013 next week, and I need to make an announcement that there has been a change. The lecture by Gustavo Artigas, The Virtual Demolition of a Fort Worth Building, that I hope some of you have been following, which is the next stage for his piece, Vote for Demolition, which is in the Mexico Inside Out Themes in Art Since 1990 exhibition upstairs. That lecture has been moved to 5:30, so it'll be 5:30 to 6:30. Seating will begin at 5. This is to accommodate a lecture by Renzo Piano on his impending addition to the Kimball that opens very soon, so it's a preview. And given our support and excitement for that project, as well as the serendipitous opportunity for this kind of interesting correlation, I think, between the two lectures, a building being built and a building being demolished. So I'm hoping that you can all mark your calendars for that and pass the word on to friends, those that you think might be interested in that lecture. So tonight we are privileged to have with us one of art's important collaborative husband and wife teams, Newton and Helen Mayer Harrison. And I have to note right up front that the artist and curator, Janiel Engelstad, is to thank for our good fortune. Having brought the Harrisons here in conjunction with her intriguing change-making endeavor, making art with purpose, otherwise known as MAP, in this occasion MAP 2013, which is a festival and exhibition of projects currently underway throughout the DFW Metroplex. Having worked for almost 40 years with biologists, ecologists, architects, urban planners, and other artists, initiating collaborative dialogues to uncover ideas and solutions which support biodiversity and community development, the Harrisons are among the leading pioneers of the eco art movement. Their concept of art embraces a breathtaking range of disciplines, working as historians, diplomats, ecologists, investigators, emissaries, and art activists. Their visionary projects have led to changes in government policy and expanded dialogue, leading to practical implementations throughout the U.S. and Europe. In the early 1990s, they formed Harrison Studio and Associates to make the collaborative nature of to accommodate the collaborative nature of their work. Work which has been represented by Ron Feldman Fine Art in New York since 1974 with solo and group exhibitions too numerous to recount and absolutely spanning the globe. In talking with Janiel before the lecture tonight, her conversations have indicated that their list of students who have studied with them is a virtual who's who's list in art. So they've not only had influence through their work, but also through their teaching. They've been recognized throughout the years with recent awards, including the 2010 AWE, as in awe, inspiring, Award for Arts and the Environment by the Chartered Institution of Water and Environment Management in association with the Center for Contemporary Art and the Natural World, CIWEM, as well as most recently, very recently in fact, the NACS Lifetime Achievement Award for Originality in Mapping. CIWEM, I was going to go on to say, this award was given in recognition for their acclaimed work, The Force Majeure, which is a distillation of works on the theme of global warming and climate change. And tonight we are here to gain insight into the ideas and fascinating practice of the Harrisons in their presentation, The Force Majeure, from the Tibetan Plateau to the highlands of Europe to the Sierra Nevada and then the bays of San Francisco. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Newton and Helen Mayer Harrison.
You know, the problem with those kind of introductions is I don't often recognize who she's talking about. I'm going to tell an introduction story. We were in the Czechoslovakia before it split. It was 1991. We just finished the Sava River work, working in the pit mines, and staying at the academia there. Well, we get up to make a talk in a room a lot like this, lots of wood around, and lots of folk, and a very chunky man, a very chunky man, obviously a bureaucrat, stomps in, runs up the steps of the stage, runs across the stage. Helen and I don't know what to do. And he takes a big medal and he slams it on Helen. That big. And then he turns to me, but I'm ready for it. I stick out my chest. He tosses a big medal on me. So we'd never got a medal before. Not only that, we didn't know why we're getting this medal. So I thought, well, maybe there's humor in the Czechoslovakia here with, never mind the Stasi. And so I said, well, you know, folk, maybe if you don't like our talk that much, do we have to give the medal back? And so this, I expect laughter. Helen expects laughter. They break down into small groups and start discussing it. Folks are really strange in all kinds of places. So whenever we get introduced, I get remembered this, and I look to see if somebody's going to come running down the steps. The Lagoon Cycle is a 360-foot-long mural in 60 parts that rolls up, and the last work in it, which is about global warming, and was written in 1978. Yeah, 35 years ago. And the piece is in the Centre Pompidou. It's in their collection in the basement. The curator who acquired it left. The director who acquired it left. The new director came in and said he didn't like it. So he stuck it in the basement, and there it spins for the last 15 years. But the piece itself, the final piece itself, was a piece of prophecy that has driven our work and is the basis for what we call the force majeure. What we did was, at the final part of this long discourse between me and Helen, we got a world map. We had to go to France to get it because we had to get the United States out of the center. And then we drew in the at 100 meter, at 100 feet, around 100 meter, what the world would look like. And Amazon Basin fills up. Florida disappears. Good part of Australia fills up. All kinds of things happen. And this is the narrative that we came up with.
The ocean is a great draftsman. It seems that if all the ice melted, the ocean's levels would rise about 300 feet. So we drew a line across the nets as best we could at the 300-foot level and thought about how the land would shrink as the ocean grew. And the waters will rise slowly at the boundary, at the edge, redrawing that boundary continuously, moment by moment, all over, all together, all at once. It is a graceful drawing and redrawing, this response to the millennia of the making of fire. And the waters rise slowly in the Red Sea, in the Dead Sea, the Caspian, the North, the Baltic, and the Black. The ocean gyres will redraw themselves, as will the currents and the tides. And over time, gracefully, this rising tide will flow up every river that once flowed down to the sea, and each fresh water tongue will withdraw before the advance of the salt. up the St. Lawrence, the Columbia, the Amazon, the White Nile and the Blue, the Volga, the Danube and the Thames, the Seine and Loire, the Rhine and the Rhone, and the Garonne, the Ganges, the Congo, the Tigris and the Euphrates, the Yellow, the Amur, the Irrawaddy, the Lena, the Potomac, and the Snake, and all rivers named and unnamed, and the floodplains that are farmed upon now and lived upon will become marshes or swamps or bogs or shallow inland seas, and as beds for swollen rivers or shallow inland seas, and the tropics will become uninhabitable, and the far north will become temperate, and corn and rice and wheat and beans and plantain, maniac and yams, and all the grains and starchy roots known and unknown, named and unnamed, will have to grow elsewhere than now, and most life, known and unknown, will have to go elsewhere than now, as great parts of the vast eastern seaboard of the United States and parts of Europe near the North Sea, and much of the South America near the Amazon, and China somewhere, and Russia in some parts. And in this new beginning, this continuously re-beginning, will you feed me when my lands can no longer produce? And will I house you when your lands are covered with water, so that together we could withdraw as the waters rise?
Now, it's upon us. In 78, our research showed it was probable. The issue we came up with, though, was not technological at all. It was, listen, a heat wave is going to come on us. And what we later call a new frontier, two new frontiers will happen. One, a heat wave is a frontier coming at us, quite different from old-fashioned frontiers where you move toward it. And a water frontier will come at all lands facing the ocean. So the question emerges, not only what do we want to do about it, but will we help each other? And as you look at our belief systems, and as you look at territoriality, and as you look at our legal systems, and as you look at each country holding its own, doesn't look like we're going to help each other. So what to do? So Helen and I have spent the last, we'll move forward 20 years. About 20 years later, we're in Europe, and we get a telephone call from somebody from a place called the Schweizer Stiftung in Germany, where they'd seen some of our work. They asked us to write a book. We said, we don't write books. He said, you're going to have to write this book. We said, why are we going to have to write this book? He said, well, you know more about the European watersheds than anybody, and we're a group of people doing the Hanover World's Fair, and we've just been pushed out, and the World's Fair, which is supposed to be about the ecology, they just gave the food pavilion to McDonald's. And so we're having 10 people write books. And some Nobels, actually. Helen and I were quite flattered. And in fact, we got the best reviews. Not because we had the best ideas, in my opinion, but because we're writers, and the rest of the scientists weren't writers. So, but anyway, it was one of those ironies that happened. So, then he calls us back. He says, you know what? You're the only book that makes a proposal. So what do you want to do? We said, well, we're artists, man. Let's make an exhibition. That's what we should have done in the first place. So we called together a group of people. We had an idea. The idea was the transformation of Europe. ecologically speaking, to face the coming drought and flood. And so we wrote the following.
From Peninsula Europe. We believe that Peninsula Europe is at a bifurcation point, at the point of change and self-transformation, all of them from the Romans through the Middle Ages, through the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, from modernity and now. That territory we call Europe has many times rebuilt its landscape economically, politically, culturally. It has rebuilt its belief systems and rebuilt its ecosystems. Now we imagine a new set of emergent properties suggesting that it is indeed a bifurcation point in a state of becoming, a point of reorganization its own complexities into a new form of entityhood. For instance,
The first thing we had to do, we said we wouldn't write the book or do anything else until we figured out what Europe was. After all, we're from California, and if we make a big mistake, we're going to really get chewed on. So we got maps of Europe, and we make this amazing discovery. From a bird's eye view. Want to read it? It's right there.
From the bird's eye view, no matter which way you look, the forms of the Russian plain are distinct and separate from the rest of the European peninsula. Continuing to look at the heartland of Europe is surrounded by waters with its eastern boundary, divided from the Russian plain by the Dniester River. Looking south from the Carpathians down to the Black Sea, and with the Vistula flowing northwest into the Baltic, these rivers form a boundary, leaving a physical land connection to the Russian plain, if perhaps only 30 kilometers. Focusing on the peninsula alone, the high grounds emerge as figure, the lowlands as field, the waters as frame.
Thus, what we had was what we call a field of play. We had a frame, we had a figure in that field, we developed concepts about that figure in the field. We bought this, particular map because it's in all the schoolrooms in Europe. And it's how they teach geography, and to the kindergartens. And we thought, this kind of a map, could we make an icon? Could we, if you lifted the mountains off, could you do that? The discovery we made, which we think is true, was not only that the peninsula of Europe is decidedly different from the Russian plain, and therefore, and surrounded almost by water, therefore we could call it what we did, but that the mountains, as they move from, I guess, take me a minute, sorry about this. The mountains, as they move from the, the Carpathians across to Spain, the physical properties create different ecosystems, watershed by watershed. And if you look at the different ecosystems and the different growth systems, they create different cultures place by place. And this place has more languages, more sub-languages, more subtext about clothing, even, than any other place around. And we have a hunch. We haven't proved it. But we have a hunch that what we're looking at is how geology makes ecology, and out of ecology springs culture. So, with that in mind, we made a proposal in our work that the temperature is going to rise in the high grounds, lots of the forests are going to die, and you got to do something about it. So the first thing we did was ask the question, what are the high grounds? I mean, where does... And the alpine definition of high ground is where the tree line is. And we decided we were going to dump the alpine definition. We don't have any... nobody owed... We hadn't signed on to that. Rather, we were going to invent a new definition. And then that's the neat thing about being an artist. You don't have to follow the rules. And what we did was said, well, let's make our high grounds where the waters begin. And where the waters begin is about, 1,500 feet up. And so those were a series of studies we made with our map makers in Toulouse to locate the high grounds and to locate the high ground shape. Our position was that you had to rehab the high grounds if you wanted to save the waters of Europe. And that's what this was about. And the whole show, these are watersheds. This was the dirtiest watershed in Europe. But we found at the very top a clean area that gave off a whole bunch of, like 100 million cubic meters a year. And if you just didn't take that water, would flush it. This water, the Bauhaus Dessau was there where we were working. And this river was so dirty that the cow's milk had to be taken to the toxic dump if they ate the grasses nearby. You folks here don't have that experience yet. But if we keep polluting, we get near it in some of our river basins. So then we said, there's got to be a good place if there's this bad place. So we find one in Austria. This gives about 400 million cubic meters a day to, it's from the Austrian Alps. It's a sort of limestone rock there that waters go through, purify. And for 300 years, the Austrians have been guarding that place, and Vienna has got its water from there. So it's possible to think in 300-year terms. And that's how we got to start behaving, I think. At any rate, we tried to get a watershed map of Europe. The countries were so disagreeing of each other that everybody had their own watershed, and you couldn't get a watershed map of Europe. And we bitched to the EU, and we were told to go to Switzerland, they made better maps there. Wherever we went, nobody knew how. So we had won a fair amount of money from the German government and the European Union, so we commissioned our map makers to make one, and so we gave it away. So this is the first watershed map of the peninsula of Europe. We then had them break it apart into pieces to see what you could learn if you could see all the fragments. It was interesting what you could learn. You could learn that there are a lot of mountain ranges around the edges of Europe, and wherever there was a mountain range, the watersheds were small. And where there's big flat centers, the watersheds were large. But once you'd learn that, we didn't figure out anything else. So we have the show, and it had to be in three countries. This is the Ludwig Forum in Aachen. It had to be in a bunch of languages. And that's me and Helen speaking English to a bunch of German students with a translator, a board translator.
The countries were?
Holland.
France,
and Germany. So you had to have three countries with good museums before they, and catalogs and all that stuff before they give you a fund you. So it wasn't that hard to do. What you're seeing here is one of the key installations. There's a big map, but you'll get to it on Europe, we'll get it later. This is the high grounds lifted off on a water map, and it's this that needs to be rehabbed. And we've made a drawing of it that big, and that drawing also can exist an inch and a half across on a button, and we thought we made an icon, except nobody cared. Let me show you what I mean. Whoops. These are some of the watershed maps. These are the kids, and I guess in Holland. But you see, like when we tried to make an icon, see what it was. First you start with the map as a field, then you lift the figure off, then you draw the figure, then you scale the figure. And we found when we put this up in Toulouse, the kids played a Walkman and danced. So, I mean, you never can tell. Also, most places we go, we consider the most endangered species in the world the topsoil. Anybody can stick a shovel in it and wreck the ecosystem near the shovel. So we always have we generally try to make earth in every show we do. In this case, we brought in all this earth of I guess they were manures of various kinds, and sewage, and there were horsefly eggs in it. So the museum got a taste of, for 2 days, horseflies running all through it, and we were not popular. And we said, fear not, it's just the ecology worker. You've hired on ecological artists. What do you think? We faked it, since we pretended we knew such things happened, which of course we didn't. But, you know, what the hell.
I would like to say something about that before you quit.
What's that?
Before you quit it. What you see there is the very interesting fact that we found. We've done a number of floor maps. And in the floor maps, people look at their places differently. In Holland, we took a certain number of the certain area of the lowlands and made a floor map. And it was an aerial photo that was done on the ground in Delft tile. And the grandmothers would come and the grandchildren and say, look, how do you get to school from my house here this way? Or how do you find the store when you have to go? And they would be down on their knees playing with the maps. Or they got dancing around them on another group in another country.
Yeah, and some of the kids would get on the Carpathians and others would get on the Austrian Alps, and then some would get on another mountain range nearby that they all knew, and they'd holler recipes back and forth. You see, you never can tell. And we're open to stuff like that. Well, we did a piece for the show called The Mountain and the Greenhouse. We wanted to show it to you. It was the work of Dr. Georg Grabherr, and he's a senior ascologist and a professor in the Austrian, in Vienna.
University of
Austria. Their big university. And they, in the 80s, were trying to prove global warming. And what they did was they selected a mountain, Schreinkogel, and they selected four keystone species. And every time the temperature went up, like a 20th of a degree or 10th of a degree, they'd go and check where the species went. And they were all moving up between 10 and 20 feet every 1/10 of a degree centigrade. So he was after, remember, there's a lot of people who doubted global warming at all back then, even now, but back then it was, you could doubt it. And he was after proving it. And so, So this is his research. And what we did was we invented a piece. That piece is really a movie. And it's a little movie that gets into global warming and says things that he can't say because he'll lose his grants. So he shows the piece and says, and if he has a sympathetic audience, he explains that he taught us artists everything we knew. Conversely, if he has a hostile audience, he explains that, you know, those crazy artists, look what they did. Thing is, this is what we call a stalking horse work, where we'll act as stalking horse for if something in science needs saying, but there's a great resistance to saying it, and so that's the only time we'll do this. Too often, scientists think us artists are illustrators. We'll illustrate their work and put it up on big screens and get them out of the books. But that's not what we do. We're basically storytellers of a specialized kind. We actually believe that every artifact in the culture that you can see and the whole a landscape is the result of people telling each other stories in the very beginning. A city here, a bridge there, Fort Worth here, Dallas there, you know. And so when we go to work, we'll tune to that story, and if we have arguments with it, we'll veer it in another direction if we can. So, finally, 6 or 7 years pass, and we come to the concept of the force majeure, and we come to it this way. We're asked to do another variation on Peninsula Europe, and so we make a proposal. Want to read it? We make a proposal for research that would enable the Peninsula Europe high ground concept to be tested on the ground as a pure water generator and as a buffer against global warming, drain basin by drain basin. I really want you to read it. So, what do you have here? You see this? That's 500,000 square kilometers of high ground forest. It's the wrong forest. They planted it for lumber. It's going to die. Well, what are they going to do about that? Look at, you see all the brown? Let me see if I get to it. Yeah, oh, yes. Well, good God. Okay. All the brown you were looking at was about 2.4 million square miles of farming. If they lose farming, wait a minute, you'll see why the goal of this work is. If they lose their farming, they lose the forest, the rivers become intermittently dry and wet, the population increases, the waters rise, and what are they going to do? We had our class propose this to the European Union, since we have connections there. And our connection said, don't tell us anything about this, it's too complex. So, anyway, the goal of this work was, how about reading? It's up here, Helen. It's on the screen. Helen?
Oh, the goal of this work is to invent a new trans-European forest from Portugal and Spain over the Pyrenees across the Central Massif to the Carpathians and somewhat beyond. The concept suggests that complex mist forests and grasslands can create a strong enough sponge phenomena in the available earths to replace, in good measure, the waters once supplied to the rivers and the lands by slow summer snow and glacial melt. The core research to locate appropriate forest types will be translatitudinal and paleobotanical.
Does anybody know why we as artists would worry about paleobotanical research? Well, I guess we're going to tell you whether you want to know or not. You see, the Eemian, about 115 to 130,000 years ago, was much wetter and much warmer, but mainly much like the prediction is, can't be sure, much like the weather we're going to face in the next 50 to 100 years. If you dig down far enough, that's generally 100 meters, sometimes 50, sometimes only 20 meters, and you pull up cores, the pollen in those cores will tell you what lived there. If that tells you what lived there, then you begin to have a way to think about assisting the migration of species. Why would you want to assist the migration of species? Well, because we've got 11 million square miles of farm. You can see we like big numbers. We've got 11 square million square miles of farmland. When you got that much farmland, you've knocked off the seed bank. It's simple. When you then have changed the chemistry of the earth, it's a little more acidic, and done a whole bunch of other things, the species can't move that fast. So we need to begin to invent. We need to begin to invent methods of cooperating, not manipulating, cooperating with nature. And for that, we have written a manifesto. It's called the Manifesto for the 21st Century. Is it around somewhere? Hold it. We'll get there. can't find it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, here. Do you want to read it or should I?
I'll read it at this point.
We negotiate these things, you know. When you're married long enough, you better negotiate or you're really wrecked.
No. A manifesto for the 21st century. We at the Harrison Studio believe, as do others, although differently perhaps, that a series of events have come into being, beginning in the time of Gilgamesh and even before, beginning with agriculture and the first genetic manipulation, beginning with the culture of animals and ongoing genetic manipulation, beginning with globalization 6,000 years ago with the salt routes, and a little later the silk routes, and later and later and later others, especially with science informed by Descartes' clock, and with modernity concealing the cultural landscape that once existed and deconstructing nature thereby, from the Industrial Revolution to the present, until all at once a new force has become apparent. We reframe legal meaning ecologically and call it the force majeure. We of the Harrison Studio assert, as do others somewhat differently, that the force majeure framed ecologically enacts in physical time outcomes on the ground. Everything we have created on the global landscape, bringing together the conditions that have accelerated global warming, acting in concert. With the massive industrial processes of extraction, production, and consumption that have subtracted forests and manipulated the topsoil, profoundly reduced ocean productivity while creating a vast chemical outpouring into the atmosphere, onto the lands and within the waters, that altogether these things constitute the force majeure.
It does go on, and it's on our website, theharrisonstudio.net, and it ends with something that... Are there any physicists in the audience? Well, why should a physicist come to this audience? What happens is that if you study physics 101, dumbbell physics, let us say, which is all we were able to manage, you realize there's something called the conservation of energy. And we are running, with all of our processes, against the laws of physics. And so we're heading for collapse of some kind or other. But there's so much redundancy in our systems that we may be able to back off it or not. Don't know yet. So by this time it's 2005, 2006, we give a talk for the Darwin 100th year anniversary, and people ask us, what do you want to do for Britain? And we say, well, how about we deal with global warming around the whole island? How about we make a model that shows the water rising in 2-meter increments with storm surges? Then everybody becomes a planner, because you can see where your place, your house, your friends, your school, your business is going to, what's going to happen to it if you live within 20 or 30 feet or 30 or 40 feet of the sea. So we do this map, which says what a 5-meter rise would do. 10,000 square miles, a lot of miles. What a 10-meter water rise. We have these wonderful map makers in Toulouse. They, you give them a problem like this and they have at it. They do the research well. Well, if we're looking at a 15-meter rise, that's what things look like. There's the model on the floor.
It's a three-dimensional model. And it's served by...
six projectors.
By six projectors. And they project onto the map the movement of water and what it covers and what it does not cover. And you see what's happening if you get a 2-meter rise. You see what's happening if you get a 6-meter rise. You see what's happening to the land if you get a 10-meter rise. All of these things become clear to people and more obvious. And with, as a result of this, we won a...
We won a prize for doing... It's called the Cy-Wem Prize. It was a whole bunch of industries. We're not used to industries giving us prizes. But it was for raising consciousness of global warming
on the whole
island. For
making global warming clear to the British public, which is what they wanted to do.
Now, we have a problem. It's about 10 of 8. This thing's only supposed to last, an hour? And we've got another 20 minutes, half hour to go on this. Can we, or should we end it when we end? Should we end it at 8? How many people have to leave at around 8? Okay, well, what we'll do is impose on your time a little bit more. So the first thing we did was we said, what would happen when London, when hundreds of thousands of people have to move up from London? And so we began to invent these mad towers. And then we invented a forest that would, on the one hand, supply the city with much better water, and on the other hand, pull in a lot of carbon. We had a good time with that. But the most important thing we came up with was a question. Actually, all our best work was a question. The question was, well, you know, how would a village, could you design a village that took in more carbon than it let out, and that the landscape did the work? And the answer was yes. Whether we could do it or not is another story. But the answer, but it was a worthy thing. It came from a key insight. The insight is that well-managed grasslands sequester about a ton of carbon a year, a little less. Well-managed temperate forest, open canopy, in the main, sequester about 2 tons of carbon a year, a little more. So if you have, say, 9,000, if you have 27,000 acres, let us say, which is 42 square miles, and one-third of it is forest and two-thirds of it is meadowland, you end up with about 36,000 tons a year sequestered. Now, for a town of 9,000 people in that area, in the Pennine area, of 9,000 people, they use about 5 tons a year. So you can pretty much, if you discount airplanes and stuff. So that kind of a 9,000 village needs a 27,000 acre footprint for the land itself to sequester that much carbon. That poses a big problem, because that means that if you did it for all of England, you could handle about 15 million people, and England has 65 million people. 15, 30, 45, 16. 4 times too many people. 4.5 times too many people. So there needs to be some kind of education that says we've got to producing people. We've got to stop producing people so much. The village terrain we located with a team from Sheffield College, landscape folk, and it's up in the Pennines. It's sheep country that doesn't work very well. It's this kind of land. And we propose... we don't have time to read it. We do not have time to read it.
Okay.
And we find the land. We take a satellite view of it, and by golly, it's all fragmented. We take a look at the population, and the roads running through it, and it's only got like 5 or 6,000 people there. You could put a village there. We, well, the site's about 40 square miles, where the shape of the watersheds, we should go there. Those are the shape of the watersheds. Well, the shape of the watersheds determine in good part the shape of the meadows, which in turn determines the shape of the forest. And altogether, this new open canopy forest would suggest, well, it would sequester really more than 50%. So that's the design we made, and that's the final design we made. And what it was about doing was, we were about the business of debating the developers in England. The developers were buying land, and they were going to make smaller, greener houses in the same way they always made. And we need to think differently, and we need to reframe how we form and build our built environment. And so this was designed as a critique, and to create a new narrative around the building of things. And then we designed normal-looking housing, but we invented the foundations in such a way that the earth would regard it as a rock, and not regard it as a continuous shape that cut a big chunk of earth from the other earth. So the earth is allowed to become still ecologically continuous under the buildings.
And, but the life in the earth, the importance of the topsoil, which none of us realize, is the millions of different kinds of bacteria or tiny nematodes, all of things live there. And they make the soil that is possible to grow things in. They make the soil that our food depends upon. They are important for our life, and we don't even recognize that they exist. But they're there doing it, and we have to take care of them.
Because so the question we is, can we design to respect the most endangered species of us all that looks like, most of the time, dirt? Now, then we get ambitious. We imagine a ring around the Pennines, where we make a village 71 times, and 71 of them, and that gets maybe almost 300,000 people, which is about 50% of the number of people who would need to move upward if the waters rise 2 meters, which is so likely. So that's our thinking there. Well, 91, the Dalai Lama's research director showed up in our studio, and he asked, what did we think of His Holiness's Peace Park? And so we had this, we didn't know any Holinesses. And so we made a faux pas of some magnitude. We said, His Holiness who? Because we didn't think it could possibly be the Pope, although it would be awfully nice if Peace Park showed up as religious decisions, ecological ones. And he said, why the Dalai Lama, of course, leaving off, you idiot. He's very polite. And so he said, why don't you write him a letter? We think he'll like your work and stuff. So we write him a poem. And the poem is the end, the last few lines of the lagoon cycle. The ocean will rise gracefully. Can we withdraw with equal grace? A peace park at that scale is a statement of equal grace. And we send them this thing off. And lo and behold, in a week we get a letter back saying, from the Dalai Lama, say, hey, let's get going on this stuff. We'll publish it in the book that's being made on us. The reason was that we had by accident addressed him as one of his names that nobody's supposed to know, and that is Oceanic Consciousness. So you never can tell when you run into this guy. You just need to put one foot in front of the other, folks. So well, now 20 years pass again. No, 15 years pass again. And they're having a show called The Missing Piece. And it's to honor the Dalai Lama. So we call up our map makers in Toulouse and we say, hey, folks, make us an azimuthal equidistant projection map with Tibet, the Tibetan Plateau as the center. Make the Tibetan Plateau, oh, in this case, 6 feet across, the rest of the world 1 foot on either side, shrink it, and then make it look like a bruise. It's in trouble. So this is what comes back. We go back and forth because we consider this kind of mapping kind of painting. And we come up with this. But we also come up with a concept that springs from Peninsula Europe and from many other things. And I think you should read it.
Okay.
And this is where the force majeure kind of thing works out. It's called Tibet is the High Ground.
Okay.
Is it too small? You want me to read it?
Research. No, I'm trying to...
This is not it.
Yeah.
This is it.
Okay. Research indicates that on the Tibetan Plateau that the glaciers will shrink so much that their melting borders will dry up, profoundly affecting the Salween, Mekong, Huangho, Brahmaputra, Yangtze, Ganges rivers future, and the Indus, as well as the Indus river system that traverse Inner Mongolia, China, Tibet, autonomous land, some India, Burma, Laos, Cambodia, South Vietnam, Bangladesh, Kashmir, Pakistan, and a force majeure has come into being in the form of global warming that will work to the disadvantage and stress of 1/16 of the Earth's population, or about 12 billion people, who live in seven drain basins. 1.2 billion people who live in the seven drain basins that comprise over 2.4 million square miles. Thus, we make an unlikely proposal in this highly stressed probable future by generating the paleological ecological research in order to locate forest and savanna ecosystems which existed in Eemian interglacial period when temperatures were similar to those projected in the near to coming, and therefore after to locate local similar ecosystems that exist in our now, and to begin designing and in part creating the process to assist the migration of a palette of species able to replace or restate those now coming under the extreme danger, thereby generating new forest and grassland, which will in good part replace the slow water releasing properties of the glaciers and snowmelt, by in part creating a 2.1 billion square kilometer sponge to normalize rivers and to secure the lands from flood and drought. Thus, an adaptation comes into being at sufficient scale to sequester 6 gigatons of carbon every decade.
See, the point is this. We calculate out it costs a couple of trillion dollars to do this over 40, 50 years. That's about what we pay for a war in a decade, a couple of wars in a decade. The whole issue here is we need a stunning reallocation of resources if we're going to meet the kind of problems we're going to face here. We're taking it up in the Sierra Nevada, but we're journeyman artists, okay? So we journey where we're told, and we take up the problems of the place that we're told. So we don't sit with some master plan at all. We improvise out of the moment. So with all this going down, the Sierra, what's the matter?
I think we want to say one thing first.
Well, go ahead, say it.
Tibet is, before we go to the Tibet, I want to finish one thing.
You've read the whole thing.
Yeah, no, I understand. What I'm trying to say is that what we were trying to do there with the Dalai Lama was that we realized that we couldn't, the biggest help we could give him was to restore the Tibetan landscape, was to bring that back, was to see how we could restore the trees, how we could restore it so that he could make a peace park that would be there on top. And that was our plan for the Dalai Lama, to restore Tibet.
Well, Helen, can I say something? This has been read.
Please. Yeah.
Okay. The issue was that when the Dalai Lama asked us to do something, we didn't do the Tibetan Plateau at all. We actually tried to restore the rivers coming off it because it had been so forested that the sides of the Himalayas were under great stress. But moving forward from that, we then get invited to go to the Sierra Nevada by the Nevada Museum of Art. And they asked us what we want to do. And we said, well, where are we? He said, you're in Sierra Nevada. So we said, well, how big is here? And they're thinking like their town. And we're thinking like the footprint of the Sierra Nevada, which happens to be 24,000 square miles. So we tell them we want the 24,000 square miles, please. And so they say, but we can't buy you land like that. And we say, no, thank you. We don't need you to buy a damn thing. We need you to agree to do a 50-year project, which they immediately do. And we have to go through Helen, we're out of time, really. And so we do this big piece on the Sierra Nevada at the museum and a couple of other places. We make a 44-foot-long aerial photograph map using Desert Research Group's skills, put all the watersheds on the wall. It's a pretty powerful show. Showed it at Feldman, New York. Actually got some good reviews. But the issue was that when you looked at the mountains, the bark beetle was already there, and the climatologist lets you know that it's going to warm 10 degrees up there, and so most of those forests are wrongly planted, not all, but most, and or much, and they'll die, and fire will get them, and so we said, look, can we get a watershed and test out the upward movement of species? And the head of Berkeley Sage Hen Watershed, a guy named Jeff Brown, said, yeah, sure, you can have our research station to do this. So it's 9,000 acres. It's the Sage Hen Watershed, which you can see there. We map it. Then we locate five sites, each site 550 feet approximately above the last. Then we get a $250,000 grant from the, I guess you call it the Metabolic Studio, and we hire our principal scientists. We as artists then do the research design, and those are our sites. We just cleared them. 12,000 species have been planted, are going to be planted. 12,000 plants will be done. There'll be about 40 or so species grouped. Three sets per site is controlled. Then out of that bunch, we would expect 10% to live, and they would be the basis for our next planting.